Welcome to Bloomberg Opinion on Bloomberg Radio, bringing you news, comments, and insights from Bloomberg Opinion's worldwide team of editors and columnists. I'm your host, June Grosso. This week, a historic boom in shale production was a bust for stock prices. Also on the show, what a decade of Netflix did to Hollywood. Plus, inequality is up, but economists differ on how much. But first, America is going to have to reckon with an internet that's becoming less American. That's according to Bloomberg Opinion columnist Shira Ovidey. She writes this week about the music app TikTok. So, Shira, for those of us who aren't familiar with TikTok, tell us about it.
Yeah, so turn to the nearest teen if you want to know what TikTok is. But basically, it's an app that lets people record short video clips that are usually skits or music videos or kind of stunts set to music. And this app became very popular kind of all of a sudden in many countries around the world, including the United States and India and some other places.
So you write that the U.S. is conducting a national security review of TikTok. The U.S. Navy has alerted personnel about it, and a foreign investment committee is considering... What is going on?
Right. It sounds funny, right? This is sort of a silly app used by teens mostly. But the reason behind the National Security Review and these other warnings is that TikTok is owned by a company called ByteDance, which is a Chinese technology company, based in China. And there are people on, you know, both sides of the political aisle in Washington who say because of TikTok's Chinese ownership, they're concerned that the company may be collecting data that could eventually find its way into the hands of the Chinese government. Because of the uniquely close ties in China between industry and government. And they're also worried that, again, because TikTok is owned by a Chinese company, that the company could be pressured to sort of censor views about China in ways that present a kind of sanitized view of the country to the rest of the world. So it's kind of a silly app that has maybe profound implications for national security and foreign policy in the United States.
So in your column, you raised the question about whether any internet company that's controlled by either China or Russia or one of the countries that we have fundamental disagreements with can exist.
Yeah, and to me, that's the underlying issue about this controversy now over TikTok, that really, for the first time, U.S. citizens and the U.S. government has to confront what it means for the internet in the United States to be less American. So for the most part, the internet services that we use in the United States are coming from American companies or from companies in countries that are relatively aligned with the United States, you know, Japan or Sweden or name your country. So this is really the first Chinese-based app that has gotten popular in the U.S., and so we're now forced to confront this situation. One, I might say, that many other countries around the world have been forced to confront before now of what does it mean if we're using internet services from countries in countries that we have fundamental disagreements with? And I don't know what the answer is, to be clear, but it does feel like this is a little bit of a moment. This otherwise silly app called TikTok has made us confront this big momentous issue about the future of the internet.
So is it mainly security concerns that bring this up, or is it their policies that they might enact?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, some of the concerns, I think, are simply based on the origin of TikTok and ByteDance, the Chinese parent company. And some of the concerns are, look, legitimate questions about policies of ByteDance, that company has also been forced to confront what it means when they're going outside of China. Again, for the most part, Chinese internet companies have been popular mostly in their home country and with the Chinese diaspora elsewhere. So TikTok has also had to think, well, what does it mean if we have to comply with rules about the internet and about free speech and other things that are different than the rules that we have applied in China? And that's new for them, too.
Well, you also say the world is divided into two internets.
You know, this is an issue that technologists have been talking about for most of this decade, this kind of idea of a splinter net, as they call it, a bifurcated internet, a balkanized internet. And the idea is that in the dreamy way that we imagine the internet of the past, it was kind of this globalized system where everybody played by the same rules. There were no national borders on the internet the way they were in the real world. That was never really true, but I think it is becoming less true, where as the internet adapts and evolves and matures, it's becoming a place where there are more borders among countries, that China, for example, has long had this kind of parallel internet universe that is governed by its own set of rules and largely walled off from the rest of the world. There's a discussion about kind of a European internet. Again, the many countries in Europe have different views of data privacy and kind of monopoly-style power of big companies, and so they have developed some rules for internet companies that operate in Europe, and other countries also want to write different rules that comport with their national values. So you see that in places like Russia and India and Vietnam. And so if this ideal of a single global internet ever were true, it's certainly becoming less and less true over time.
So outside of this one isolated instance of TikTok and its parent company, is this issue being studied?
I mean, the idea of a splinternet, of the internet fragmenting into nationalized parts, it is being studied. I think the issue about what it means to have popular internet services in the United States from non-American companies, that's something that we haven't really had to grapple with beyond TikTok, in part because until now, again, most of the internet services that Americans used have come from American companies or from companies in countries that we are allied with.
So do you have any idea where the investigation of TikTok is at this moment?
I don't know. So this national security body that is investigating TikTok, it's very secretive. I do not know where they are in this investigation, in this investigative process. The ultimate outcome could be that ByteDance, which basically operates TikTok in the United States because of an acquisition that it made of a company based here, it may be forced to unwind that acquisition. We saw that, for example, there was a dating app for gay people called Grindr, which was acquired by a Chinese company, and this U.S. national security body forced the Chinese owner to rescind that acquisition, again, because of data security concerns.
Thanks, Shira. That's Shira Ovidei, a Bloomberg Opinion columnist. As the 2010s came to an end, U.S. energy just had its most successful decade ever, and yet turned in the worst performance in the S&P 500 by a wide margin. Bloomberg Opinion columnist Liam Denning writes this week about how the shale boom was a bust for stock prices. So, Liam, why was the decade so good and yet so bad for energy?
I know, it's a paradox, isn't it? So the way I think, and by successful, I mean we saw the biggest increase in U.S. oil and gas output of any decade since it got going in the late 19th century. The way I think about it is it's a little like, you know, WeWork or Uber. If you think about those companies, right, think about Uber. Who made money out of Uber? Well,
Uber.
The investors, the early investors did.
Yeah.
Not so much if you're a late investor or you bought in at the IPO. The management did. I think, you know, Travis did quite well out of it. And customers did quite well because we basically got a service below the cost it actually, you know, took to actually
taxi
produce
cabs,
that service.
Yeah.
Shale has been a bit like that. You know, if you think about natural gas, for example, natural gas up until about 2008 was a volatile price. It used to range, you know, from about, you know, anywhere from like $2 up to about $15 per million BTU. Then shale comes along and just floods the market. And we've now had natural gas prices basically around $2 to $3 for, you know, 11 or 12 years. And essentially, as customers, we've done quite well out of it. Investors, not so much. So what you've seen is in some ways, kind of like we work with the office sharing market or Uber with the personal transportation market, funded by very generous capital markets, they have gone out and they've grabbed market share. Hasn't made a lot of money. There's not much money dropping to the bottom line, but they have transformed those markets. And shale has kind of done the same. It's transformed the market, but if you're an investor, you haven't done very well out of it.
Now, is this because of the governance of it?
That's been a big part of it. And again, I see a parallel there with, you know, some of those tech unicorns where there's a lot of essentially a lot of power concentrated in the hands of management. Not a huge amount of oversight because, you know, for one reason or another, the boards haven't been particularly, harsh or aggressive in terms of curbing bad behavior. So what we've seen with the energy companies is we've seen some outrageous examples, you know, things like some of the stuff the late Aubrey McClendon got up to when he was running Chesapeake Energy, to more prosaic things, you know, executive compensation packages that basically are like heads I win, tails you lose. You know, if you're running an oil and gas company over the past 10 years, you've done amazingly well when oil prices are high, and you also haven't done too badly when oil prices are low. Investors haven't had quite the same luck. And you've had a lot of incentives to essentially go out and spend a lot of money grabbing market share, growing your production. Incentives were not that aligned with generating a return on capital or paying a dividend. That started to change recently. But for most of this period, it just wasn't really there.
So what's the fallout from all this?
So where we are now, you know, at the end of this decade, obviously, the shale revolution in the US has transformed the oil and gas market. You can see this in all sorts of ways. We've obviously got, you know, very cheap natural gas, for one thing. It's kept a lid on oil prices. It's essentially transformed OPEC. It's transforming geopolitics. The U.S., as you may notice, seems a little less concerned with its dependence on Middle Eastern oil these days compared with 10 years ago. But on the other hand, it's also kind of wrecked the energy sector's relationship with investors. You know, what we've seen is even as the U.S. oil and gas business has kind of thrust itself back up the rankings in terms of the share of the global energy market, its share of the S&P 500 has collapsed. It's down below 5%. It's the lowest in several decades. Investors just aren't really willing to give these companies the benefit of the doubt in terms of oil prices coming back. Part of the reason for that is that every time the oil price has gone up, the shale industry has responded very quickly, produced more oil, and driven prices back down. The big question for 2020 is whether that relationship has changed or is changing fundamentally. And the reason being, we've reached such a point of investors just being disenchanted with this sector and walking away from this sector that companies have begun to talk about more shareholder-friendly things like instituting dividends, like reforming their governance practices, like not going out and doing ginormous deals at massive premiums that end up destroying their stock price. Now, will that last? It's too early to say. And we've had this recent rally in oil prices just over the past month where Brent has gone back up towards $70. If that were to, say, continue into 2020 and suddenly oil company managements felt a little less pressure on them, would they go back to the old ways? I like to think they won't. I think they've had enough of a scare over the past year or two. But, you know, old habits die hard.
Are any of the top execs at these companies still engaging in bad behavior?
I mean, I think in general, you know, there haven't been really egregious examples I can think of on off the top of my head in the E&P sector. Definitely in the pipeline sector, it's still going on. That's a whole other story. But in E&P, what you still have is, I think the biggest issue is what I call this sort of collective navel gazing. So
you have to explain that.
Right. So when bonuses are set for the CEO, the CFO, the corporate officers, you obviously have, you know, three or four different incentives that go into that. The one that is there almost as a constant is total shareholder return and how I compare with my peers. So what they do is they say, you know, last year or the last 3 years, what's been my total shareholder return relative to the other E&P companies? Now, the problem with that is, as we've said, the E&P sector has been an absolute dog. So if you're the best performer in an absolute dog of a sector, what has that really got your investors? So what we've started to see is some companies say, you know, we're not going to benchmark ourselves against our peers. We're going to benchmark ourselves against the market. We have to beat. It's no good for us to just beat the other E&P companies. We have to beat the S&P 500 or whatever index, you know, you care to mention. Very few companies do that. ConocoPhillips is one. Chevron has switched to that. But it's still the exception rather than the norm. And I think if anything could help to change the performance of this sector, it would probably be some sort of reform along those lines.
Thanks so much, Liam. That's Liam Denning, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. The rise of streaming video leader Netflix this decade and the looming presence of big tech spurred a rash of mergers that are transforming the industry. Bloomberg Opinion columnist Tara LaChapelle writes this week about what Netflix did to Hollywood, and she joins us now. So, Tara, the television landscape has gone through some major changes since 2010, hasn't it?
So the past decade, we really saw this whole definition of TV change. You know, it used to be when you talked about TV, you were talking about cable television with, you know, the TV guide with hundreds of channels. You probably only watched a handful of them. And nowadays, what I think it means to most people is something broader, Netflix or streaming generally. I think fewer and fewer people are thinking about television as a cable box with a set number of channels with different numbers assigned to those networks. I think nowadays it's about Netflix, Disney Plus, these new apps that are rolling out, HBO Max that's coming next year, and I think it's going to increasingly change that way into the 2020s.
So, and then you in your column, you talked about the media merger mania.
That's really been the business effect of Netflix. You know, I think when a lot of people think about Netflix and streaming, they see not just their own habits changing, but also the way content has kind of changed. You know, there's an emphasis on having more content, having enough to watch. In some cases, that may have sacrificed the quality of some shows we see on places like Netflix, for instance. But there was a sense that we needed more of it. But in the business world, I think the real effect has been these mega mergers where you're seeing lots of U.S. media giants get together and feel like, even though they're so large, they're still not large enough. And so, you know, AT&T bought Time Warner and HBO. So suddenly you have a wireless company owning these media assets. You had Disney buy Fox's studios, as well as Marvel and Star Wars. You had CBS and Viacom get together. Charter and Time Warner Cable are one company. A lot of people don't even realize that still. So there's just been like deal after deal after deal this past decade. And the effect of that has been the list of U.S. media giants has gotten increasingly shorter. And you're starting to see these big tech companies encroach on that. So now when we think about big media companies, the media giants, it's Disney, it's Netflix, but it's also Apple, Amazon. And those were names that really weren't in the mix just a few years ago.
Can you pinpoint when the streaming wars started?
So I think it was around the beginning of the decade, actually. So in early 2010, Netflix was added to the iPad as an app. And shortly after that, it was on the iPhone. So suddenly you could take Netflix streaming in your pocket with you wherever you go. It took a while for cell phone plans to catch up to that, where we had unlimited data and people were willing to spend to watch, you know, binge on video on their devices. But I think that was a real turning point, even though it may not have realized it quite at that moment. And then it was just a few years later, I think in the summer of 2015, where Disney said ESPN was losing subscribers. And that was a huge moment. We saw all the media companies' stocks sell off, and it was just this big fear. And I think, you know, even though that abated a little bit in the months and quarters after that for a while, I think that that was the moment where the streaming wars really began. I think if you had to pinpoint a date, it was then, because Disney, as powerful as it is, as, you know, beloved as it is, even they were saying ESPN, this most valuable network on TV, was having issues and people were cutting the cord. And I think that told you where this industry was heading.
And I realized the other day, because my streaming services went out, my how little I watch on network television. Are there any numbers for how many people don't even have network television anymore?
I'm not sure what they are at the moment. A lot of people still do. There's still a lot of households that have traditional cable network television. But I think that those numbers are going to keep heading toward the streaming route. I think millennials and then younger generations aren't even going to really understand why they need cable TV. You know, I grew up with it, so I still see the draw of having all these channels and having live TV and coming home after work and just, you know, something's on. I don't have to pick it. Right. But I think I'm in the minority there. I think more and more people are saying, you know, I want to be able to pick and choose the shows that I like and just subscribe to those apps that I need. And, you know, when a new app comes out with a new TV show I really want to watch, maybe I'll pause my subscription on this other thing and subscribe to this one temporarily. And I think it's becoming that game where people are willing to sort of jump back and forth between subscriptions rather than pay $100 a month for this big cable bundle.
Does that hurt the services, the people jumping back and forth, or do they sometimes benefit because people forget to cancel that the subscription that you got for a very, you know, a cheap rate?
I'm sure they're hoping for that, right? They're hoping we forget to cancel. I don't think we've really seen the effect of it yet. Even at Netflix, I think churn, it's been hard to really capture because a lot of these apps are so new still. You know, Disney Plus just launched in November. Apple TV Plus was also in November. But I think over time, that's going to be a real problem. And I think the companies are already figuring out a way to solve that. And the biggest pain point is that we pay too much for having all these different services, and we don't like that we have to manage all these different apps, right? Like, it's clunky. It's frustrating to jump back and forth and not really know where a certain TV show lives. You know, maybe you know Mandalorian, the Star Wars show, is on Disney Plus, but where is Succession? And, you know, and you're trying to remember where all these shows live. So I think that what the companies may try to do is go back towards this idea of bundling, where they make it easier, where you can pay in one spot for a set number of apps, and it'll be easier to find the content you need. You know, this weekend I was looking on my, I use PlayStation to access my TV, and I was searching for this show called You on Netflix, and I found it, and I went to click on the icon, and it said You, but it took me to Netflix's home screen. It didn't take me straight to the show, because there's still sort of that clunkiness when you're trying to browse on these different consoles and devices that manage these platforms for us. So I think we're not quite there yet, but I think the companies recognize that this is frustrating for consumers and it's costly, and it'll start to backfire because people will decide, well, maybe I can go without HBO Max. Maybe I don't need Disney Plus for the next few months.
But won't that seem a lot like what we're used to? If they start bundling it, then we're going to be stuck with whatever's in that particular bundle.
Exactly. I think what we're realizing is that, you know, maybe cable wasn't so bad, but also there is no perfect sort of subscription, right? You know, these companies have gotten bigger. They have more scale. They've become sort of tribalistic about their content. And so it's going to be really hard for consumers to get a la carte service and pick and choose what they want. But I think what we have right now is probably too frustrating and costly. So there's going to be another sort of wave where things change again. And I think the next change is probably some sort of bundles. And I bet, you know, the cable giants will want to get in on that. Amazon and Apple have already started to move toward that. So that's going to be like the next big thing in the 2020s.
And in all this, what happened to the movie studios? Are there any independent studios left?
There are, but, you know, they're looking smaller and smaller next to these giants. Think about this. Netflix's revenue is now more than the entire North American box office combined. I mean, that's how much big it's gotten. And then when you think about the box office, it's like a third of Disney stuff. So, I mean, you really see like how much these bigger companies are controlling these markets. You know, Lionsgate had bought Starz, the premium cable channel. And, you know, Lionsgate is really kind of struggling with that. The deal isn't gone as well. Lionsgate itself is looking kind of vulnerable. CBS and Viacom have combined, and Viacom owns Paramount Pictures, which, you know, was struggling for a long time, losing lots of money. They've gotten profitable again, but still, I mean, they're not quite there. I think what a lot of these studios are doing is supplying content to services like Netflix, because they're realizing that's what people are doing. And when it comes to the actual movie theaters, people are coming out for the big blockbusters, the big Marvel movies. And so we're really changing our sort of consumer habits when it comes to these things.
Thanks, Tara. That's Tara LaChapelle, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Inequality in the U.S. has risen a lot during the past few decades. That sparked outrage among segments of the public, raised concern among economists and other social scientists, and revitalized America's socialist movement. That's according to Bloomberg Opinion columnist Noah Smith. So, Noah, we hear a lot about inequality in the U.S. Just how bad is it?
Well, it's gotten worse, but we don't quite know how bad it is because, you know, rich people don't tell their wealth. You know, they don't report their assets to the government every year. And they do report their income for taxes, but there's a lot of evasion and there's a lot of classification that's kind of ambiguous. So it's actually hard to tell how much the rich people actually have. And most of what we know comes from this trio of French economists, Thomas Piketty, who's pretty famous, Emmanuel Saez, and Gabriel Zucman. And the French economists, their analyses always reveal extremely high and rapidly increasing levels of inequality of both wealth and income. And every time they release a new paper that revises their estimates, they revise it upward in the direction of greater inequality and faster increases in inequality. Now, that might be right, but some other economists are like, hold on, wait a second, let's look at some of these assumptions that they make. And so other teams of economists have done their own analyses, and usually they come up with numbers that are substantially lower. So they'll, you know, for example, the French economists come up with numbers that say that wealth inequality has gone from 24% to like 42% since like 1990, which is an absolutely enormous increase. And then the, you know, that's like an 18 percentage point increase or something like that. And then the other teams will find that it's gone to like maybe between 28 and 33%, say. You know, that's a modest but still, you know, worrying increase.
So,
and so they, everybody agrees that inequality has gone up over the last, you know, 40 years.
Well,
but whether it's gone up by absolute leaps and bounds or by sort of a moderate amount is still in dispute.
So why is it going up, even a moderate amount? Why does it keep going up?
Well, that's a big question, and we don't really know. My money is on financialization, as you allow basically owners to collect more of what, you know, companies produce to essentially just buy and sell companies at will. And sort of, you know, you have private equity, which slashes tons of jobs when it buys companies. You have financial markets that allow finance companies to collect large fees to trade assets, things like that. I think that's a big part of it. Globalization is probably a big part of it. Just sort of changes in the tax code. I mean, we've reduced capital gains tax a lot. That just mechanically is going to increase the wealth of the top because they're not paying as much taxes on their capital gains. We reduced income taxes. We reduced a lot of taxes. And, you know, that just increases the rate at which point at which wealthy people build up wealth. And so there's other reasons, too. And there's probably a whole host of reasons. But I mean, the question is, how big of an effect does this have? And that's really what various economists sort of disagree about, although you usually hear from the three French guys, and you usually do not hear from all the people who say that the increase has been more modest.
Why is that? Are the three French scientists, are the three French economists so superior? Is their research better? Why? Or do they just keep talking a lot more?
They're relentlessly focused on inequality, and they've been studying it for decades, or at least Piketty has. Well, they've been studying it for a long time, and that's pretty much all they study. And they've been, you know, they widely publicize their numbers. And their numbers are alarming. Like, people pay attention to alarming things. Like, there was a New York Times infographic that showed that rich people pay less taxes than the middle class now. That's highly questionable data. But it got retweeted, you know, 100,000 times or something. And that's insane virality, because people, you know, we're in an age of political unrest and dissatisfaction, and people are looking for, you know, looking for things to be, you know, to be upset about. That's not saying this isn't a worthy thing to be upset about. I think it is. But the question is, how upset?
So what do you suggest is the best course to try to solve or even out some of this income inequality?
Well, I think that, you know, the French guys have got it it broadly right when they say, you know, raise taxes. We lowered taxes a lot, especially on capital income, and it doesn't appear to have produced a boom in investment at all. So try raising capital taxes, and, you know, hopefully it won't hurt business investment, and we'll actually get some greater equality from that. Things like capital gains taxes, estate taxes, you know, raise taxes. But the question is, do we need to, you know, go to extreme steps like nationalizing industries and just raising taxes to extremely high levels and blah, 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 in order to address this? Well, maybe, maybe not, because if the other economists are right, then the problem isn't severe enough to warrant sort of drastic steps like that. So I'd say start with the moderate stuff and, you know, sort of see how it goes, see if you can, you know, reduce that trend a bit. And then keep doing research, you know, to figure out who's right. Don't demand like definitive results right at the beginning of this, and just sort of make policy moderately more progressive, and then see how that goes, and then you can do more if necessary.
Thank you, Noah. That's Noah Smith, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. We continue looking back on the decade that was. The 2010s exposed an industry that cared about lining its own pockets, often at the expense of the companies it bought. That industry, private equity. Joe Nocera wrote the column for Bloomberg Opinion and joins us now. So you dubbed the 1990s the NASDAQ decade. What are you dubbing the 2010s?
I'm dubbing the 2010s the private equity decade. There were, at the beginning of the decade, there were about 2,000 deals. By the end of the decade, there were 6,000 deals almost in 2018. Worth $750 billion. That's a lot of deals. And private equity has not just done huge deals, but, you know, we're at the point where they're buying, as I noted in one column this year, they're buying sandwich shops.
you said, well, I half expect the bodega down the street to be bought out.
They'll pretty much buy anything at this point. And they have just become a force to be reckoned with in American capitalism, and not necessarily in a good way.
Exactly. Tell us a little bit about the piling on of debt and what it's done to some companies. For example, Toys R Us. Children might be interested in that.
Toys R Us is the poster child for how private equity has become distorted over this decade. You know, Toys R Us went out of business primarily, not only, but primarily because it was so saddled down with debt, it couldn't afford to make the payments. And, you know, the stores were shuttered. The employees lost their jobs. There was no severance. But, you know, Henry Kravis and KKR did just fine. A couple of years ago, the Limited shut down, and its private equity owner, Sun Capital, put out a release, sent out a note to its investors saying, "Don't worry, we doubled our money." So you just have to wonder what the methodology is when these companies are going under, but the private equity firms are doing fine because they pulled out all these fees and all these dividends, and yet saddled the company with unsustainable debt.
Is it deal making for deal making's sake, or is it deal making for the investor's sake?
Well, when I was there's a couple of things going on here. You know, 3 decades ago, when it was really just getting going, you know, they would claim that they were helping make companies lean and mean, and they were bringing in better management, and they were Improving companies so that when they came back out into the public markets 5 or 7 years later, they would be improved companies and the stock price would go up. You almost never hear them say that anymore.
Well, you mentioned some other stores that went under, which I didn't know was connected to private equity till now. Gymboree, Sports Authority, Linens and Things.
Right.
So
the retail sector in particular is struggling under the burden of private equity debt. Even companies that have not gone under, like Neiman Marcus, have loads of debt that they are struggling to deal with. And so when you get into something like the retail downturn that we've had lately, that's where this really starts to hurt, because the downturn makes it more difficult to make the debt payments, but that also means that you have to lay off workers, that you can't make capital investments, that all your money is going to debt, and it's not going to help the company.
So what's likely to happen in this decade with private equity? Back off or become worse?
I do think that there's going to be a reckoning financially. If there's a downturn, there'll be a lot more companies than just retail that'll get hurt. But I also think there'll be a political reckoning, especially if the Democrats do well in the 2018 election. I mean, Elizabeth Warren has already kind of made them a poster boy for what's wrong with Wall Street and capitalism. The name of the bill that she has put in is to stop private equity. It's called the Stop Wall Street Looting Act.
Says a lot, doesn't it?
Yes. So I think this last decade was pretty great if you were a private equity manager. I think the next decade is going to be a lot tougher, both financially and politically.
Joe, thanks so much. That's Joe Nocera, a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. That's it for this edition of Bloomberg Opinion. You can read more at Bloomberg.com/opinion or at OPI and Go on the Bloomberg Terminal. For Bloomberg Radio, I'm June Grosso. Thanks for listening, and remember to tune into the next edition of Bloomberg Opinion right here on Bloomberg Radio.